Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 9th of July. Last week, there was an incredible scientific discovery made, and it was a discovery. I love the image of scientists working on something for years and years and years. This one took about 50 years, and the Independent in England says in a recent article, now at last the Higgs boson particle has been found and a new chapter in our understanding of the universe can begin. This was a discovery that was more than 30 years of painstaking experimentation and also a huge machine, and we'll hear about that machine and of course about the experimentation as well. This particle could be, news reports are saying, one of the greatest achievements in science, rivaling the discovery of the structure of DNA in 1953 and also the Apollo moon landing. It can explain why some particles have mass, but why others, such as photons of light, do not. And I'm interested in finding out why this could be one of the biggest. What are the ramifications of this discovery? Why is it so huge? It was first postulated half a century ago by the retired British physicist Peter Higgs and scientists at the European Organization for Nuclear Research in Geneva stopped short of saying that this was definitely what they had found, but they're pretty sure this is what they have found. So what does all of this mean? What new discoveries now may have the door open for them because of this discovery? Why did it take so long? And indeed, what is it? What is it, for those of us who don't understand all the scientific intricacies of this, what exactly was this discovery? We're very happy to have David Derbys as our guest. David is a physics teacher at the University of Chicago Laboratory Schools, and he was a research student of Peter Higgs, who probably will get the Nobel Prize for this discovery. His student years were from 1975 to 1979 at the University of Edinburgh. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Those of you with profound scientific minds, I urge you to call this hour. And those of you who have scientific minds who can help explain all of this to with our guest, to those of us who don't have those kinds of scientific minds. But we understand this is a big announcement. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. David Derbys, thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Let's go back, if you would, please, because I'd like to associate this discovery with the gentleman who was your teacher. Go back to 1975 at the University of Edinburgh when you were there and you were a research student of Peter Higgs. What was he working on? What were you working on?
Peter's lifelong interest is an area called spontaneous symmetry breaking. And at the time, 1975, Peter's model had been put to good use by a professor at Harvard, Steven Weinberg, and a Pakistani physicist named Abdus Salam at the Imperial College in London. And these guys had put together a very realistic model of something called the weak interactions. And everyone was sort of hopeful that this was going to turn out to be a good theory of the weak interactions, but no one knew for sure. And so Peter was engaged, as many other physicists around the world were engaged, in trying to figure out clever ways to see if that was going to work or not. But the truth was that what was really needed was the experiment to do it, to see if that was how nature actually behaved. And so while the theorists were busy, we were really sort of waiting on the experimentalists. And that finally has taken place now.
And the big question that you were looking at was what? How the universe began, how it operates, what's the big picture?
Sure. Okay, so I apologize if some of this is very fundamental and bores your listeners and you, but I don't know where people are.
No, I think it's fascinating. We just need to understand what it is. Some people will be very sophisticated in our audience. I can guarantee you that. There will be others like me who are not.
Okay. Yeah. So before roughly 1933 or so, there were two known fundamental forces in nature, gravity, you know, why things fall down, and electricity and magnetism, why the magnets stick to your refrigerator, why you get a spark sometimes in the winter when you touch something metal. And when people began to probe the nucleus, they learned that there were two other forces that they didn't really understand. One had been discovered by Marie Curie and Pierre Curie and Henri Becquerel, that on occasion a neutron in the nucleus turned into a proton and spat out an electron. That was called beta decay. So the force that's responsible for beta decay is called, not very sensibly, but this is what it is, the weak force. There's also the force that holds protons and neutrons together in the nucleus, and that's called the strong force. These are not the greatest things, but we're stuck with them.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, people didn't know how to describe these forces very well. There were many, many attempts made, but almost all of them suffered from one or another mathematical difficulty. So when you've got something that works very well, and there was just a simply tremendous theory of electricity and magnetism that had been united with quantum theory in the late 1940s by a number of people, people said to themselves, well, we have this electricity and magnetism that we understand really well, and we have this model that works really well. What we should try to do is adapt that model and see if we can make something very much like that for the strong force and the weak force. And so these attempts were made, but there were two significant problems with them. The first significant problem was that they didn't seem to give sensible answers for high energy. The second problem with them is that they seem to be required to operate over very great distances, much as gravity and electricity do. Gravity is holding the Earth in its orbit about the sun, and we're a very far distance away from the sun, and yet these other two forces, the new forces discovered in the 30s, only operated at very short distances. And people realized that typically short-distance forces require very heavy things, and yet the photon that you referred to in your preamble, in your introductory remarks, the photon that is responsible for electricity and magnetism has zero mass, and so it operates at infinite distance. But the things that were going to do that for the weak force and maybe the strong force seemed that they would need a massive force, and nobody knew how to do that. Actually, I can make this much simpler, and I should. Scientists and physicists in particular really like symmetry. So the big question is, why are the masses of the subatomic particles so different? If you look at the charge of a proton, it's exactly the same size as the charge of an electron, except the proton is positive and the electron is negative. But the masses are very, very different. The proton is almost 2,000 times heavier than the electron. Now, why on earth is that? And so people said, well, maybe the universe isn't quite as symmetric as we imagined it might be. So what must be going on is that the symmetry, if there is a symmetry, has to be slightly broken. It has to be a little bit off. And so that's what people were trying to do, is to figure out why the objects in the universe, you know, the subatomic particles had different masses.
Hmm. And this is done, it has specific... It's specifically aligned to nuclear research. I was interested that scientists at the European Organization for Nuclear Research were commenting on this. Is that the umbrella of where this has been, all the research has been going on? And if so, why? And if it's broader than that, how broad is it?
Sure. The name of the organization, in some sense, is a misnomer.
Oh.
The thing was set up as the European Center for Nuclear Research, and my French accent's lousy. I'm not going to try to impose it on your listeners. But the acronym in French is the European Council for Nuclear Research. But they don't really do much in the way of nuclear research. All this stuff started off as nuclear research, but that's only because that's the outer layer of the onion. People are digging deeper and deeper into it. They don't really do nuclear stuff. What they do is more sub-nuclear stuff.
I see. And tell me about the gentleman who cried when he heard this announcement, who was your teacher, who sounds like he's an enormously brilliant and interesting man who is concerned about nuclear issues as well.
Right. Well, he's always been, I think, politically very active. He is by nature really a pacifist. He's opposed to the use of force. He is very, very quiet and very, very private.
Hmm.
And for the longest time, when I got involved with, you know, because my own PhD research was on an area related to spontaneous symmetry breaking, and when we'd talk about this, he would always talk about, quote, the well-known anonymous boson, or the, quote, well-known anonymous mechanism. He would not use his own name in connection with this thing, which I found interesting.
Huh.
He does now, but I think sort of reluctantly. And I think he does that because everybody else does it. But this is a guy who is just tremendously modest and has never tried to put himself out there. He has never sort of wanted to be in the public spotlight at all. I think he sort of hates this stuff, to tell you the truth.
Oh.
I mean, I think he has to do it, but you know. Well, I'll give you, for instance, if you go back and you look at the video of the broadcast, I got up at 2 a.m. Actually, I didn't really go to sleep at 2 a.m. on the 4th of July to watch this. There are five other people alive four other people alive who did very similar things at about the same time. One of them, unfortunately, has died, a Belgian named Robert Braut. And another fellow, Tom Kibble, who is a professor in London, decided not to come. But then there were three other folks who were involved in this, and you know they came in very early, and they took center stage, and I kept looking at the screen, where's Peter, where's Peter, where's Peter, and finally, honestly, about 4 minutes before this thing was due to start, Peter Higgs came in with his friend Alan Walker, and he was recognized almost immediately, and there was a round of applause, and he goes to find a seat on the side of the auditorium. He didn't really want to be there. You know, he had to sort of be dragged there, I think. He's a tremendously nice guy, loves music, loves good food, loves good wine. He was married to an American from Champaign, Illinois, and she died, unfortunately, a couple of years ago. They separated amicably a long time ago. They have two sons. You know, I've met the sons once. I never met his wife. I talked to her on the phone one time when I answered the phone in his office when he wasn't there. You know, he very much keeps to himself.
Hmm. So here he's having the pinnacle of his career, this discovery. All these years he's worked on this and worked on this, but he doesn't want to be noticed. So it's a terrific week, but it's also a terrible week because everybody's paying attention to him.
Yeah, I think that's actually a very good way to put it. But I'm delighted by this. All of his friends are delighted by this because we think it's something that, you know, if we'd had our way, would have happened a very long time ago.
Hmm. So tell me, what does it mean, David, for this to be in the press described as one of the greatest achievements in science? The Independent article says it rivals the discovery of the structure of DNA in 1953. Why is it such a big thing? And then the obvious other part of the question is, where does it lead us?
Right. Well, it's hard to know where new discoveries are going to take you, but let me explain why everybody is very, very happy about this in the theoretical community. Theoretical physics is really difficult. I know that sounds kind of stupid, but what I mean by that it's difficult is it's not that the math is hard, although the math can be very hard, but it's difficult because you're trying to figure out how nature behaves, and that is an unbelievably hard task. You know, the stock market goes up and down, the economists don't know what to do, and you're trying to figure out something that's very tough to measure. I mean, it's not hard to measure what the stock market's doing, you just look at the numbers, but for what's happening inside a nucleus, that's not so easy.
Mm.
And, you know, people sit down, they talk to each other, they come up with ideas, they try to figure out ways to measure it, and they just don't know. And so you do the experiments and see if it works out. And I would say that Einstein got it exactly right. He said the most valuable tool of a theoretical physicist is the wastebasket. So Peter Higgs and these other guys have this idea that's going to solve two very serious mathematical problems that people have in their description of the behavior of very, very small particles of nature. Going to kill two problems at the same time. Great idea. And so they have this idea. They don't know if it's true, But on the basis of this idea, some other guys invent, I mean, theirs was just what would be called a toy model. Like, you know, if nature were to behave in this way, in this very simple way, this is what would happen, and so there are some experimental consequences. Okay. So two other guys take that ball and run with it and build a whole new, you know, brand new theory of the weak interaction that describes the beta decay I talked about. Mm-hmm. And there are some consequences of this model. And some very important consequences were that two heavy photon-like objects should be discovered. Well, actually three. There's a neutral guy called the Z for zero because it has no charge, and W for weak. And the W comes in plus and minus. And so if the ideas that Peter Higgs and his collaborators or his friendly rivals had come up with were correct, then you could apply it to this theory of Weinberg and Salam and Glashow. And if that theory was true, then there should be these two W particles and this Z particle. And those things were looked for and found. Yippee! Looks like things are going. Well, no, this is great. This was all done about 30 years ago. So people said, great, we're on the right track. However, all of this stuff, you know, everything that was measured worked out great, but the whole thing rested on the foundation stone of the Higgs boson. If you can't find that Higgs boson, then you don't really know. Maybe it was a lucky guess for all this other stuff. Now, people really didn't think that, but there was this nagging worry that maybe they just gotten lucky. Maybe Weinberg and Salam had an idea that was pretty good and, you know, came up with this, but maybe the working is wrong. You know, they don't know. And so the reason why it was very important to find the Higgs boson is because it told them that the mathematical structure on which all this stuff was based was solid. And if it had not been, the whole thing might have fallen apart. We don't know what the hell we're doing. And that would be, you know, great news in some sense to the theorists. They get to go back and, you know, hire some more postdocs and stuff. But we wouldn't know what the world was like, and that would be sad. So everybody is very happy because we have made this assumption for 50 years that we thought we knew what we were talking about. And if they had not found this thing, this is absolutely an inescapable consequence of the mathematics of the past 50 years. If this thing had not been found, then we don't know what the hell we're talking about, and we're just a bunch of fools, you know? And so this is a real strong vindication that we do know what we're talking about. But to me, the magic is this thing was predicted 50 years ago. 50 years
right,
ago.
Right, I know, 50 years ago. Wow.
And finally, here it is.
We're going to take phone calls, and we have some emails that have come in as well. Our number is 800-486-8655. Physicists had a big announcement last week. Our guest got up at 2 in the morning on the 4th of July to see this announcement that they have found the best evidence yet for the Higgs boson, the subatomic particle. And we're talking about how it happened, and we have yet to talk more about how it's going to change our understanding of space, time, and matter, our understanding of the world. We'll talk about the, because we always want to know the practical implications of all of this. We'll talk about that as well. To your phone calls momentarily, our guest, I should remind you, is David Derbez. He's a physics teacher. He's at the University of Chicago Laboratory Schools, and he was a research student of Peter Higgs from 1975 to 1979 at the University of Edinburgh. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, 800-486-8655. Our first caller is Spencer in Cedarburg. Hi, Spencer.
Hi. Boy, this is a great show. My wife and I have a daughter who's in the UW system graduate school for theoretical physics, and we had the opportunity to go to CERN a couple years ago. And I just want to encourage anyone who has the opportunity to stop in and visit that place. It was amazing. The tours aren't given by tour guides or docents. They're actually given by physicists who work there, and which is great. And the guy we had is an experimental physicist from England. And just how that machine operates is amazing. The temperatures that operates, it takes them a couple hours when they fire it up to get the protons up near the speed of light. And that when the thing's operating at the proper temperature, several hundred degrees below zero, it operates on, I believe he said, 12,000 amps. And doesn't lose a single volt. And in the museum, they have this wonderful screen, this big oval screen, and the computer records and immediately reproduces some of the best proton collisions when it's up and running. And you stand in front of this huge screen and watch in slow motion as these protons collide, and you get these tremendous spiraling explosions. And it is just such a meaning of life place when you're there. You just get that sense. And they have a wonderful little gift shop there, so if you're not a physicist like I'm not, or my wife is not, they have great things there to help lay people understand what the machine does and what the basics of particle physics are. And it is just an amazing place. Mm.
And tell me, before we find out more about the machine, how your daughter happened to become a student in the area of theoretical physics.
Oh, she just has been interested in science ever since she was a young girl.
Oh.
And we always talked about science with my wife and I and her older brother. And she just got the bug. And like your guest was saying, it is a lot about the math. I never really understood that. But that's how these folks communicate. You know, they talk like we talk, but when they talk together and say, this is my idea, they hand back and forth pages of mathematics. And you look at this stuff, and some of it doesn't even have numbers in it anymore. You know? It's just all letters and squiggles and all this stuff.
Isn't that something? What was her response to the big announcement last week of the Higgs boson?
They've been following that because her studies are in gravitation. And so she and her professors and the other grad students have been following this for a long time. And so we always listen to like shows for like you have, or Ira Flatow on Science Friday. We're always listening for news of CERN. And they're, at the time we were there, they're talking about how they're doubling the energy level every 2 weeks and getting the machine used to running at those energy levels, looking for that energy level where the Higgs is located.
Yeah. I'm so glad you called. Maybe it'll become a big tourist attraction now, David, huh?
We could hope.
Tell me what's there and how it happened to be there. What's at CERN exactly?
Well, so... It happens to be exactly on the border between France and Switzerland. Just as the United States Capitol had to be chosen to be on the border between Maryland and Virginia, who was going to pay for this thing? The United States was the front runner and by far the leader in subatomic particle physics, which means basically you have to build these machines because they take an incredible amount of money. And the United States began to build these things. There was a nice one at Brookhaven. There's a nice one at Stanford, the Stanford Linear Accelerator. And then the idea was, well, let's build one at Fermilab, okay, and at Batavia. And so that was, for a very long time, the greatest accelerator, you know, in the world. But the Europeans didn't like the fact that the Americans had all these machines and could make all these discoveries. They wanted to get in on the act. And so they started CERN a long time ago. And little by little by little, the two machines leapfrogged each other. The CERN had LEP, the Large Electron Positron Collider, and then we had the Tevatron that was an upgrade from Fermi originally. And finally, they've built the LHC. And the United States has basically said, we quit. Nolo contendere, which is very, very sad for Americans. We were trying to build something called the Superconducting Super Collider in Waxahachie, Texas. That was approved under the Reagan administration, but there were cost overruns. The whole thing was supposed to cost $7 billion, which is now a drop in the ocean. But at the time, to build the tunnel, 50-mile circumference tunnel, that cost $2 billion. It seems an awful lot of money for a tunnel, but that's what it cost. And people in Congress got very nervous in the 90s and said, you know, we don't know how much this is going to cost. And they killed it. And much sadness was felt all over the United States in high-energy physics. It was kind of like, okay, well, the crown is being passed from America to Europe. And that's probably where it's going to stay for a while.
Interesting. Spencer, thank you very much for the call. Here's an email that's come in from Bill. Actually, it's on Facebook about the Higgs boson. As this evidence becomes widely accepted, what might be the next question in particle physics? And will the CERN be large enough to address future questions?
The simple answer to that is CERN is plenty big enough to do this. there's a conception which CERN really finds dangerous. So I want to try to help them if I can. There's a perception that the Large Hadron Collider was built with the sole purpose of finding the Higgs boson. Not so. It was built to find out whatever is out there, whatever that is. We don't know. It might be nothing. There might be absolutely nothing. This may be the last discovery in particle physics for the next 50 years. We just don't know. That's why it's called research. I don't think that's what's going to happen. The big question that everybody has is about something called supersymmetry. If supersymmetry is true in any way, shape, or form, then there are an awful lot of things out there yet to be discovered. In fact, in some sense, we have discovered exactly half. If supersymmetry is true. But nobody knows if it's true. There's been no experimental evidence to speak of. There are a couple of small things that maybe indicate that it's so. But the idea is that they will go to higher and higher energies to see if there's something there. I should say that it's too soon to say because we don't have enough data, but my understanding of my limited reading is that while essentially 95% of the characteristics of the particle discovered on Wednesday or announced on Wednesday are in complete accord with what people thought they were going to find, there are a couple of slightly interesting pieces of this. The way that you find the Higgs is you look for stuff it decays into. The Higgs itself is very, very tough to see. And so you look for characteristic decay particles, which are much more easily measured. And people made some predictions that most of the time the Higgs was going to decay into two pieces of light, two photons. And sometimes it was going to decay into a tau and an anti-tau lepton. And in the first case, yes, they found the decays, but the former are too numerous, and the latter are not numerous enough. So people don't know if that's just a matter of statistics, and they need more data, because all this stuff is basically a statistical argument. But the other side of the coin is there might be other stuff out there, not very far away from the Higgs boson, that is affecting the decay rates. And some people who really want to believe in supersymmetry are hoping very badly that this might be a thing called a supersymmetric top quark, also known kind of strangely as a stop. So I should mention what supersymmetry is. Probably a lot of your listeners have played with a thing called Rubik's Cube.
Sure.
And so Rubik's Cube has got three kinds of cubes. It's got the corner guys that have three faces. It has the edge cubes, which have two faces, and it has the center cube, which has got one face. It turns out that all of subatomic particles can be put into two species. There's a species called a fermion, and that has a particular quality called spin, which comes in half-integer quantities. And then there's another species called a boson, and that has spin that comes in whole-number multiples. And these guys typically are very, very different kinds of characters. In the late 1960s, early 1970s, some people got the idea that maybe there was a way to turn one of these guys into another. It would be as if a corner cube on a Rubik's Cube could suddenly become a middle cube or a face cube, you know, kind of a crazy idea. But everybody has a partner. So everybody who's in the normal world would have a supersymmetric partner and vice versa. But we have not seen one, not a single one of these supersymmetric particles, if they exist. So maybe they don't exist, or maybe they do exist, but they're just so heavy that we haven't seen them. There is a serious problem with what we understand about cosmology, in that an awful lot of the universe seems to be built up out of something called dark matter.
Mm-hmm.
We have no idea what dark matter is. Nothing. No clue. And maybe CERN will be able to find it in some higher energy collisions. Maybe some of the dark matter is supersymmetric. Nobody knows. It's a mystery.
Let's go to Cynthia in Madison. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi. I was so excited by this announcement. I got out some of my books on cosmology. And it got me wondering, I have two questions. Does the math assign a size to the universe prior to the Big Bang? And then after the Big Bang, it became rather unsymmetric, which is where they think the galaxies and so forth formed. How did that original asymmetry occur?
Well, you have asked two fabulous questions to which no one really knows the answer, at least I don't know the answer. I can tell you a little tiny bit about it, but before the Big Bang is a big mystery. Some people say it's foolish to talk about that. We have no way of knowing. Other people say, no, it's interesting. We have a way to think about that. I'm going to leave that for the philosophers. I mean, it, maybe you can get there and maybe you can't. The asymmetry is really important because if there had been no asymmetry at all, there wouldn't be galaxies.
Right.
The fact that there are galaxies and therefore stars and therefore us is because the Big Bang in its explosion was not completely the same everywhere. If it had been, then there would have been no place for gravity to be a little bit stronger and start to grab some stuff. And as it grabs some stuff, it, you know, it makes stars, it makes like galaxies. So there wouldn't have been the seeds in order to make the stuff that we see today gravitationally. It would all would have been equal.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's all equal, then there's no difference between space and mass. Everyone would be the same. It would just be a soup. But that didn't happen. Well, it turns out that at the beginning of the Big Bang, it's a quantum mechanical problem. We don't really have a good quantum mechanical theory of gravity. But an incredibly brilliant guy named Alan Guth, who was at the time, I think he was in California, but now he's at MIT. He's been at MIT for the rest of his career. Alan Guth came up with an incredibly brilliant idea that may, in fact, be related to Higgs, although we're not entirely sure, that the universe expanded very, very, very rapidly in the first few moments of its existence in a theory that was called inflation. There was a lot of economic inflation at the time, and that's where it took the name. But people have looked very carefully at the quantum mechanics of this, and they see that there are, in fact, quantum fluctuations of exactly the right size to produce the galaxies. And people have looked very, very carefully at the so-called background cosmic background radiation.
Yeah.
And they can see fluctuations that are absolutely in agreement with what people have thought quantum mechanically from Guth's work. So that looks really strong. I think that we actually have a pretty good understanding of the mechanics of the Big Bang. We're not entirely sure why it started at all. But if Guth is right, there was a Higgs-like field that provided the oomph for the Big Bang. But we don't know that.
Oh.
That's a guess. But some of the same ideas that Peter Higgs used were the same ideas that Alan Guth used. And so this is an extremely deep and important idea. I should mention that the guy who came up with all of these very, very clever ideas, the Foundation Stone, was the University of Chicago physicist, retired not so long ago, Japanese-American Yoichiro Nambu.
Hmm.
Professor Nambu won the Nobel in 2008 for these ideas.
Hmm. And you imagine Professor Higgs is going to win the Nobel for this?
You know, the Nobel Committee is it's like the umpire in baseball. You know, they have to make the decision. With what they say goes, and you can try and influence them, and you can beg and plead, and you can hope. But, you know, it's absolutely their call. I will say that I think that everybody sort of expects that this is what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But that's entirely their call. I have to say I was pleased when Stephen Hawking paid up his bet to Gordon Kane at the University of Michigan. Gordon Kane, who's a very strong proponent of supersymmetry, bet Stephen Hawking that the thing would be found before 2015, and Hawking said, nope, won't. Stephen Hawking likes to make bets. He's made 15 or 20 of them, quite famous. He usually loses. So if Stephen Hawking wants to bet you, I would take that bet. And so the morning of the announcement, Stephen Hawking very graciously said, I owe Gordon Kane $100, and I think that Peter Higgs should win the Nobel.
All right, there you go. He's probably right, huh? Tom in Wrightstown is next. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi.
You mentioned, or your one of the callers mentioned cosmology, and then your guest brought up the name of Guth.
Yes.
I've been reading a cosmology book by a man named Farrell about a mathematician, Catholic priest, Father Lemaître. Lemaître,
yes.
I'm not sure how you pronounce that. But
I think Lemaître, but yes.
Lemaître had a cosmological constant that he was debating back and forth with Einstein and those other cosmologists and general relativity researchers. Have they found an answer or come up with a theory that accepts or rejects the cosmological constant, and will the does the research at CERN have anything to do with this?
The simple answer to all of those questions is yes. So the Abbé Georges Lemaître came up with an idea he called the cosmic egg. So this is a brilliant, wonderful story, which I could go on at great length, but I don't want to get in the way of other callers. But basically, when Einstein came up with his theory of gravity in 1916, it appeared that the universe was not static, that the universe would either get larger or get smaller, and Einstein found that kind of repulsive. He felt the universe should always be here. And so he added what can only be called a fudge factor into his equations, which he called the cosmological constant, and said that this would prevent that from happening. And there was a lot of to and fro, and in particular, a Russian physicist named Friedman told Einstein that it didn't make any difference if he put the cosmological constant in or not. It would not stop the expansion or the contraction of the universe. And Einstein and Friedman had a kind of a lengthy, grumpy exchange, and eventually... at the University of Chicago, the expansion of the universe was discovered by Edwin Hubble, and then Einstein said, you know, this according to George Gamow, a colleague of Einstein's, a Russian physicist, Einstein said that the cosmological constant was the greatest mistake of his life. Well, maybe not. If you're as smart as Einstein, even your mistakes are right. And we've discovered in the past 20 years that we expected the expansion of the universe to slow down, because if you think about it, after the Big Bang, you've still got the gravity of all the stars and galaxies pulling on each other, so you would expect that they would slow down, just as if I take a tennis ball and throw it up in the air, it's going to slow down as it goes up, and eventually the Earth's gravity is going to bring it back down. So you would expect that as these things get farther, you know, as they're moving away from each other, the gravity is going to bring them back, and so maybe the universe would end in this gigantic big crunch. You know, come back to another kind of Big Bang. In fact, a lot of people thought that that might happen. But, incredibly, the expansion of the universe seems to be accelerating.
Mm-hmm.
So this
mm-hmm.
has now been given the name by Michael Turner at the University of Chicago of dark energy.
Mm-hmm.
Dark energy may be, and certainly acts an awful lot like, the cosmological constant. We haven't got the vaguest idea what it is. CERN might make some headway into finding out what is the dark energy. Nature's inexhaustible. There's no shortage of questions. Every
right.
time you find out something, there's something else you thought you understood, but you really don't.
Yeah. Thank you, Tom, so much for the call. 800-486-8655 is our number. Irene in Madison, hi.
Oh, yes, thank you. Very interesting. I'm still not clear, what is the overall objective of the CERN experiments? And also, as the energy level of these experimental explosions increase, will it approach something like the Big Bang? And is that the objective? And since the Higgs particle, I hear, is thought of to have been a spark for the Big Bang, and here you have found it, then my concern is, how safe is all of this?
Mm.
What is the risk factor here?
Mm-hmm.
And especially since the scientists know very little about it all. It's an unknown. So how safe it is at these with these explosions? Thank you.
Thank you, Irene.
Sure, sure. I understand the concern. Let me say this, that... even though the energies involved at the Big Bang they'd love to approach the energy of the Large Hadron Collider, they would love to approach the energy of the Big Bang, but that's just not possible. There's nothing approaching the kind of energy you need to make a universe that's going to be available there. This is not an explosive device. I don't think anything is going to happen at CERN that's going to cause anybody any difficulty. Now, having said that, your caller is, of course, exactly right, that we don't know completely. Every physicist is at least aware of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Maybe we've read it, maybe we haven't. There's some danger involved, but I think that the danger is very slight. Why are they doing this stuff? Why have the European taxpayers contributed $10 billion to build this machine? Because people are curious. They want to learn stuff. They want to know if their ideas about the way the world works are correct. And, you know, if when you ask questions, you get answers, and you take that knowledge, and sometimes you do good things with it, and sometimes you do terrible things with it. On the whole, I think the technology has served the planet very well. We're communicating over a device that could not have existed before people understood enough about quantum mechanics to build transistors. The Internet is itself a byproduct of CERN. The guy that invented the World Wide Web, yes, the guy who invented the World Wide Web is a man named Berners-Lee. He's an Englishman. And he put the web together so that scientists could more easily communicate their results and their questions to each other.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Where it comes from.
Oh, fascinating.
So, the thing about pure science, the thing, you ask questions because you're curious, you want to find out, and very frequently there's an unexpected spin-off of the investigation, which is a new technology, and sometimes the new technology is not realized for a century. People did not discover the electron until roughly 1896, and so they didn't really make much use of it. I mean, they had actually been making use of it for a telegraph or electric light, but they didn't really know what they were doing for a long time. But finally, we're beginning to make some very important and serious use of this stuff for communication, for medical reasons. There's just a tremendous amount of possible technology here. And we just don't know. That's why we do it.
Hmm.
If we knew what we were doing, the joke is if we knew what we were doing, it wouldn't be research. Or a better way to put it is if we knew what the answers were, we wouldn't be looking.
Right.
The reason this thing, this Higgs boson, took so long to find out is because although a lot of things were known about it, very curiously, the one thing that was not known about it was its mass.
We're going to welcome more phone calls in a moment. David Derbys is our guest. He's a physics teacher at the University of Chicago Laboratory Schools, and he was a research student of Peter Higgs at the University of Edinburgh in 1975 through 1979. And, of course, we're talking this hour about CERN announcing the discovery of the Higgs boson subatomic particle and how meaningful this is, the long time it was in discovery, and what it means to discover this hour of the program with David. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Mike in Whitefish Bay. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I have a comment and a question. My comment was that I heard Dr. Higgs interviewed the night of the celebration, and he was irritated because of the appellation that the Higgs boson was called the God particle, since he's an atheist, and he was very irritated by that. The other thing I wanted to know was how does this discovery affect string theory?
Thank you for the call.
So the story on the God particle is well known. Leon Lederman, who writes an extremely funny book and wrote a book about the Higgs boson called The God Particle. And the story goes that he wanted to call it the goddamned particle. Because nobody could find the thing. And the publisher would not allow him to do that, so he dropped off the damned part. That's the story, and he's sticking to it. I'm not entirely sure I believe it. But it's absolutely true that every physicist is kind of grumpy about it. Some physicists are very devout in their beliefs of this or that faith. Some physicists are atheists. Some physicists are agnostic. But I think that every physicist likes to keep this stuff separate, if they possibly can. So the same way they try to keep politics and physics separate. You know, it's not that they aren't important, but they sort of muddy the water a bit. With respect to string theory and the Higgs boson, supersymmetry is sort of the overarching theoretical framework in which string theory takes place. In fact, string theory was once upon a time called superstring theory, and indeed supersymmetry came out of very, very early supersymmetry came out of very early superstring models from 1969, 1973, thereabouts. So string theory and supersymmetry are very closely connected. Supersymmetry predicts not one, not two, but five Higgs bosons in the minimally supersymmetric standard model, and we don't know if that's going to happen or not. the Higgs should have supersymmetric partners, and they should be spin half things. And I don't know if they're the supersymmetric quarks or the supersymmetric leptons, but they should have partners. And I'm sorry to say I'm not as up on this stuff as I should be. For the longest time, everybody in theoretical physics went into string theory. And then, after a long time, there'd been no experimental support for string theory, and people began to get a little nervous. And nowadays, I think that string theory is, frankly, on the ropes.
Really?
I do not know. Yeah. Huh. I do not know if it's hard to say. Two of my very finest students of all time both went into string theory and learned a tremendous amount. And I was speaking with a distinguished person who I'm not going to identify. And we were talking about string theory a few months ago, and I said to him, well, my feeling about string theory is it may not be what's going to be used to describe subatomic particle physics, but I think that these are very important ideas. Mathematically, it's very significant, and something may come down the road for which this stuff is extremely valuable. And he said, that's exactly my position, he said. I think theoretical physics is making wonderful tools. They're not necessarily going to be applied directly to what people think they're going to be applied to, but this is important work, and you know the jury is still out as to whether or not the universe as we know it is supersymmetric or not, is described by string theory or not.
Mm.
We don't know.
When you were talking about your students, I've been thinking this whole hour about how important it is to have students, how important it was for Dr. Higgs to have you, because you can spend your whole life working on this, and what you thought was true may not be true, or it might not pan out, and somebody else has to take over, right?
Yes. And that, you know, if you're wondering, you know, why Peter's eyes were wet at this announcement, you know, if you spend a long time on something and it turns out that it was all for nothing, you feel kind of sad.
Right.
But on the other hand, you know, those were tears of joy.
Right.
Like, you know, my life has been, this is worthwhile. I'm glad I did this.
Yeah, exactly. And, yeah. Mike, thank you. Jim in Mercer, hi.
Maybe I should just lead with Bazinga. In listening to your talk and thinking about the Big Bang Theory, the first thing that either unfortunately or fortunately comes to mind is the television show. What has that done to the field of physics?
I can tell you my students are very fond of it. Anything that promotes kids to think about science is probably a good thing in my book. I mean, you know, Star Trek did a lot to turn kids on. Back in the old days when we didn't have these TV shows, a lot of physicists went into physics because they read Isaac Asimov or Robert Heinlein or Ray Bradbury. So I'm all in favor of it. I mean, I've only seen the show a couple of times, but I do know that there's a whole raft of physicists who actually are sort of on call, so that they try to get the physics right. When I see equations on the blackboards, I've only seen it a couple of times, they're always correct. So I think it's a great thing, and I'm all in favor of it. You know, they need a few more women.
Thank you.
They need some women physicists.
Thank you, Jim. And to put the whole thing in perspective and answer the big question, Celeste on Facebook asks, my question is, what does this mean for the future? Can we use this discovery to benefit the human race and our quality of life here on Earth?
Not immediately. Long-term, hard to know. Certainly, the hope is that with learning stuff, we move the human race forward. I believe that very strongly. I think that things will come out of this that we can't be aware of yet that generally are going to be good. Given a choice between knowledge and no knowledge, I would go with knowledge every single time. And I think that ultimately I probably won't be alive to see it. I'm 60. But probably sometime down the road there will be something that comes out of this that is very important, besides just knowing that we understand stuff better. But the direct practical application of this particular discovery, I have to say honestly, I don't see it. That doesn't mean it isn't there.
Mm.
And I certainly am not going to say it isn't. It can't be there. I just don't know what it might be.
Mm. Does it bug the heck out of you to know that you may not be alive to see it?
Not at all.
Really?
Sure. The beginning of civilization is planting trees you know you're not going to be alive to take fruit from.
Right. And are you in touch still with Professor Higgs?
Yeah, with luck, I'm going to see him in about 2 weeks.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. My wife is a fabric artist, and she's wanted to go to the island of Harris, where they make Harris tweed, for a very long time.
Oh.
So we'd set this trip up some time ago, and we were not planning to go to Edinburgh, but because of this, we're going to try to get through and see him. But he's very popular lately, as you may imagine. So arranging to meet him at a time when we're there and he's there is not straightforward. But we had a bunch of email. He doesn't do email. We had a bunch of letters leading up to this, and my sources were better informed than his sources because he doesn't use the web. He doesn't use computers at all.
He doesn't use computers?
Not at all.
Oh, my goodness. That's amazing.
Fountain pen and paper. He's kind of old-fashioned in some respects. Anyway, I said the blogs indicate pretty strongly that this thing is going to be announced on the 4th of July. You better start making plans.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote me back, and he said, I haven't heard that.
David, thank you so much. It was a fascinating hour. David Derfus, physics teacher at the University of Chicago Laboratory Schools, and he was a research student. I'm so glad he's going to see him in a couple of weeks, a research student of Peter Higgs from 1975 to 79 at the University of Edinburgh. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and Brett Jaspers for on-air production in Milwaukee.